to the hotel, so are walking in the opposite direction to myself. They advise me that I've broken the back of the walk and will be imbued before too long. This lifts me, and I muster the strength to carry on. A short while later, I pass a satellite tracking station, which fences off some of the most ludicrously large satellite dishes I've ever seen. It's all bit space station. To be honest with you, dear reader, it all goes a bit blurry at this point. My feet, which up until now have been fairly quiet thanks to the additional sockage, wave the white flag and die a sudden death. I'm left to essentially crawl for the remaining miles into Bude. There are a few more steep climbs to negotiate, and then a long final descent into the popular surfing hotspot. The sun is beating down on my sweaty mess of a body, as it has been all day. I make my way to the campsite I'm booked into, where I make a decision. I will take a day off tomorrow and book a room in a B&B for tomorrow night. I'm running low on food supplies and need to purchase some proper foot padding, insoles or such like. Buoyed by this decision and having set up my tent, I make my way to a nearby pub for dinner. As I sit eating, I contemplate the day behind me. I feel as though a physical milestone has been reached today, although I'm more tired than I've been at any point up until now. It's somehow a good tired. Chapter 2. North Cornwall. Camelot, the Turquoise Sea, and Canadian Dentists. After an uncomfortable night under the canvas, I spend the morning wandering Bude in search of supplies. I buy padded insoles and various assorted plasters for the poor old feet, as well as stocking up on lunches. Replenishing the Mars bars proves of no difficulty, but the salami search is less fruitful. In the end, I'm reduced to a multi-pack of a popular brand of processed snacking sausages. The horror. I also find a laundrette to give my clothes a desperately needed wash. My by now pretty fruity undergarments practically leap into the machine and select the appropriate spin cycle without any human assistance. I book a room at a pub around lunchtime, dump my stuff and wander down to the beach. Here I spend the afternoon basically watching the clock and wishing I was back on the trail. I honestly thought I'd revel in a day off, a good rest, maybe catch a movie, read a book or whatever. The reality is that I'm bored, twitchy, and ultimately desperate to get going again. Eventually, I sulk my way back to the pub for an evening meal and an early night. By the time the 6 a.m. alarm sounds on my phone the next morning, I'm already up, dressed, breakfasted, and heading for the door. My feet are double-socked, plastered up, and sitting snugly atop a thick pair of cushioned insoles. I stride down to the beach to rejoin the path like a man possessed, consumed by the need to be back on the trail. The sun is already shining brightly, and the skies are a clear, brilliant blue. After climbing out of Bude, I'm walking along a gently undulating, grassy hilltop path. Crowds of gulls and crows are gracefully acting out a complex display of flying prowess above me, swooping and rising with effortless speed and accuracy as the calm, eternal sea glitters and sparkles beneath. I walk past a striking monument, standing proud and isolated on the hilltop. I consult Rowley to discover it's a 19th-century storm tower, also known as the Tower of the Winds. The gentle, grassy slopes continue until I reach the sand dunes of Widdermouth Bay, where the surfers again pepper the early morning sea. I cannot pretend that I haven't to some extent lost track of what day it is already, but I'm fairly certain it's a weekday. I wonder if none of the surfers that have filled the beaches since Woolacombe have got jobs to go to. I mean, I'm obviously one to talk, maybe they're all on sabbatical too. A section of steep road walking follows the dunes as I ascend to a cliff top once more. I meet a couple of farmers working on some fencing along the cliff edge. We chat for a while and I tell them about my trip. They have the thickest Cornish accents I've ever heard, and in between each sentence I speak, the younger of them seems to exclaim, "Did I?" whilst the elder quietly mutters what sounds like "Isu?" in unison behind him. 3 months booked off work. "Did I?" "Isu?" Yes, and I'm walking the whole coast path round to Poole Harbour.
Digger? Isu?
They tell me about a decent pub at my day's final destination of Crackington Haven, and after taking a bit of gentle mocking at the size of my backpack, we say our goodbyes. I've never felt less like a brave explorer and more like an office worker from the city on vacation in my entire life. Straight away, the path becomes more challenging. A series of very steep drops and climbs to rival anything from the previous stretch follow in quick succession. I eventually stop for lunch when I arrive at the staggeringly beautiful Millwick Valley. I sit on the rocky beach between the majestic, jagged cliff faces and devour my slightly less majestic meaty rations. I watch a bird of prey, I think a kestrel, behind and above me, hovering as though frozen in time before suddenly dropping like an arrow from the sky. Way up above me, a tiny rodent of some description is having a very bad day. Back on the cliff edge, after a few more tough climbs, the views are mesmerising. Stretching back to Hartland in one direction and on to Tintagel in the other, I spot a sleeping bag on the path in front of me. It's clearly new and clean, and I assume it's fallen off someone's pack without them noticing. As I have no idea which direction they will have been walking in, I follow the walker's unspoken code of practice and carry it with me to the next stile, where I hang it from a fence post in plain sight. About 5 minutes later, I'm climbing a steep grassy hillside and I pass two elderly ladies out walking. They advise me that Crackington Haven is only another 30 minutes away, and this puts a spring in the old step. A further 20 minutes on and I'm daydreaming about seals. I'm now entering the 100 miles or so of the path where I'm advised I'm most likely to catch sight of them. I'm picturing their sweet, blubbery faces when I hear a distant call that sounds like cooey. I look all around me but see nothing. I hear the call again, and then, after a few confused seconds, a figure comes into view over the crest of the hill behind me. As the figure approaches, I realise it's one of the ladies I passed 20 minutes ago, and that she's waving the sleeping bag I found earlier above her head, slightly frantically. "Hello, I think you dropped this!" She is sweating and panting and has clearly spent the last 20 minutes chasing me along the path. No, I saw that, but it's not mine." She is visibly crestfallen, and I instantly think that the gentlemanly reaction would have been to just have said, "It's mine," and thanked her for her kindness. Feeling guilty, I say, "I'll take it from her and hand it in at the pub in Crackington." Partially appeased, she slumps off, and I begin the descent into the now clearly visible final destination. Once I arrive, I book a room at the Coombe Barton pub that dominates this small and beautiful spot, hand in the sleeping bag and order a bottle of ale. I sit on a bench outside the pub watching the gently crashing waves in the bright sunshine and think that life really doesn't get much better than this. Later that evening in the pub, I chat to the barman and a few of the locals. I discover that there is a young German guy staying here who is also walking the whole path, and just a few days ago, a girl on her own doing the same thing. I wonder if this is the same girl the owners of the guesthouse back in Coombe Martin mentioned. It's a strange thought that I am sharing this path and this journey with other solitary souls who are, to some extent, experiencing the same adventure as me. I'm undecided as to whether this is comforting or nauseating. The journey seems so personal to me, and yet to know that there are others, maybe seeking the same things for similar reasons, does somehow make me feel part of something bigger. Or maybe I've just had a few too many. The next morning I'm munching on some cornflakes. The pub doesn't have Weetabix, much to my disgust. The only other guest up at 7 a.m. is a chap, maybe in his 70s, who is using the bar phone.
"Yes, hello there. I wonder if you might have a room available for tonight. I'm walking this confounded path, you see."
He is a slight, bald and bespectacled gentleman with the booming baritone of Brian Blessed. After successfully securing a room with whoever is on the other end of the line, he seats himself in the chair opposite to me and begins tucking into a plate of scrambled eggs. "Are you walking the coast path as well?" I say.
"Oh, splendid, a fellow journeyman," he booms, looking up at me.
We get chatting, and it transpires he's walking as far as Penzance. He is a retired schoolteacher who has walked the entire path in separate sections several times over, but never in one go. He is impressed at my efforts thus far, and his enthusiasm and excitement are utterly infectious. He gives me a 10-minute talk on a product called Compede, which will apparently sort out all my foot-based problems. Somewhere during the 7th or 8th minute of this lecture, which includes a visual demonstration, I wonder briefly if he is an undercover Compede salesman or major shareholder, but I eventually agree to purchase some when I next stop for supplies. My destination for the day is Tintagel, whilst his is somewhat further along the path. He encourages me to stay at a particular castle-themed hotel tonight. It's quite the experience, I assure you, especially if you're fortunate enough to run into the proprietor. He is wearing a mischievous look on his face that unnerves me, but I agree to take his advice, as I've not booked anywhere yet. The path rises steeply out of Crackington in the hot, hazy sunshine. It continues to rise and fall in the vein of the last few days as it clings to the rocky hillsides. The sea has changed colour to a brilliant turquoise that gives an almost Mediterranean feel to the walk. I stop, exhausted at the top of a cliff somewhere past Little Strand Beach. The views in the bright sunlight are simply outstanding as I lie red-faced and panting, having slung off the blasted pack. My Compede-loving companion from breakfast appears over the crest of the hill. "Easier than Bude, though, eh?" he proclaims as he smiles down at me. He's astonished at the size of my backpack and encourages me to ditch the tent immediately. As he bounds off cheerfully at a pace I can barely fathom, I contemplate his suggestion. I've only camped a few times so far and didn't exactly enjoy it. On top of this, the accommodation so far has been a lot cheaper than I was expecting, as I'm still out of season. Could I actually lose the tent and sleeping bag and the weight that comes with it? By the time I reached the highest cliff in Cornwall, cryptically named High Cliff, my breakfast companion and I have passed each other several more times. Whilst I maintain the steady, dependable pace of an overweight tortoise with a heart condition, he appears to be walking at breakneck speed and then needing to stop and rest at regular intervals. Even though I've only just met this man, this erratic yet determined walking style seems to perfectly sum up his personality. I eventually arrive in the pleasant village of Boscastle, where I stop for lunch in the National Trust Cafe. The breathtaking views, clear blue skies, turquoise seas and tough climbs all continue into the afternoon. Repeatedly descending into beautiful rocky valleys and climbing relentlessly out of them, way up, high above the waves. The drops from the cliff edge to the ocean are sheer here, noticeably more than recently. There is a jagged edge to the tranquil summer-like scene. As I approach Tintagel, I'm tired and the feet are aching, but my observations from the last few days are definitely ringing true. This is starting to get easier. I bravely vow to keep hold of the tent for now. Tintagel is said to be the home of King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table. As I arrive, the streets are heaving with tourists, weaving in and out of the endless Camelot-themed trinket shops, selling magical crystals, Lancelot tea towels and plastic swords. I join the crowds to walk around the castle ruins before deciding to try and locate the hotel my breakfast companion recommended to me earlier that day. This doesn't prove to be difficult, as it turns out to be the giant Victorian faux medieval castle building I passed when I left the path to climb into Tintagel. Its prominent position means it has actually been in view for the last day and a half of walking. It's difficult to know where to start when attempting to describe this bold and memorable accommodation. As you walk through the giant doorway, the first thing that hits you is that the interior stone walls are painted in a striking gold. They are also adorned with framed photographs, in which the same sharply dressed, cleanly shaven, hairspray-laden man can be seen shaking hands with a variety of Hollywood celebrities. There is also a portrait shot of the aforementioned chap, in seductive, soft focus, staring down at you as you wait at reception. The effect is gloriously eccentric, and I instantly want to explore the whole building. I'm of course in the budget room, which is essentially a broom cupboard overlooking the car park, but it's cheap and well worth it to stay in such a grand abode. After I've showered and unpacked a few things, a terrifying realisation hits me. Where is Rolly? Usually rolled up and sitting tatty and used in the front pocket of my bag, he's now nowhere to be found. I have no idea when I last consulted him, so I get dressed and take a wander around the hotel and grounds, trying to retrace my steps. As I'm doing so, I get the chance to take in the decor of this imposing structure. Think, what if Lawrence Llewellyn Bowen moved into Buckingham Palace and redecorated? And you'd not be far wrong. An hour or so later, after walking all the way back down to the path via the village centre, I'm forced to concede defeat. I've not met anyone else walking the path who is using the guidebooks, but it has become habitual for me, and I'll feel a bit lost without it. There are only a couple of days left before I switch to the second guidebook in the series anyway. A new Rolly. King Rolly is dead. Long live King Rolly. A few hours later, I'm tucking into a pasta dinner in the elaborately decked-out hotel restaurant when the man in all the photographs wanders in carrying a small child. He's wearing a white linen suit with the sleeves pushed up, like a character from Miami Vice. He proceeds to do the rounds, chatting to a selection of guests as they eat their meals. I wonder if the other diners are as perplexed at this as I am. "So please do tell me what you think of my humble abode," he says, as he chats to an American couple sat behind me, as I silently pray that he'll pass me by. I needn't have worried. He takes one look at me, sitting alone, slurping tagliatelle in my faded Carter USM T-shirt and baggy shorts, gives a curt smile that gets nowhere near his eyes, and moves swiftly on. Later that evening, I'm lying in bed chatting to my brother on the phone, having already called Tasha and the folks. I tell him about the hotel and its suave owner, and he updates me on events back in the real world. It's the first time we've spoken at length since I started the trip, and it's good to describe my larger-than-life lodgings to someone who shares my sense of humour. It's a strange byproduct of being on your own on a trip like this. I probably wouldn't have seen my brother in the previous 2 weeks had I not been walking the coast path, and yet talking to him now, I'm conscious of how much I miss him. It's the distance, I suppose. The walk to Port Isaac the following day is a shorter but more challenging one. This is all I can remember from Rowley's description, as I set off without him, bright and early. A slightly sobering thought, as I don't recall the previous few days being particularly unchallenging. The going is initially easy as I steadily climb out of Tintagel. There are some very pleasant hedge-enclosed sections where I'm serenaded by multiple bird songs in the bright early morning breeze. Then things get tougher very quickly, with a series of steep descents down to sea level and sharp climbs back up to 400 feet. As ever with this section, the views at the peak of each climb are sensational. The beautiful, rugged cliffs set against the turquoise, I might be using that word too much, water, and rich blue skies peppered, and that one, with gulls patrolling diligently. At the top of Dennis Point, I stop to watch a peregrine flying by. I've never seen one before, and the sight, like the buzzards and kestrels I've encountered already on this trip, is jaw-dropping. It's gliding through the air and then suddenly diving at breakneck speed, arrow-shaped, towards the ground before pulling up at the last moment. I can't see anything that it could be hunting and so assume it's merely playing. I'm utterly transfixed by it until, eventually, it passes from view. A little further along, I pass a young chap with walking poles who holds a gate open for me. "How far are you going?" I ask, by now used to receiving the adoration of strangers when they hear I'm walking the entire coast path. "John O'Groats," he says. I'm instantly in awe, and we chat for a few minutes about the journey he has ahead of him. Southwest coast path, child's play. A bit further still and I'm staring slack-jawed once again, this time at the stunning views from the top of Bounds Cliff. It's difficult to imagine the path maintaining this level of beauty for the next 6 weeks, and it crosses my mind for the first time that I might be currently enjoying the best of it. To give weight to this thought,
I've been noticing how much busier the path has been over the last few days, with today being no exception. As the morning draws to a close, I find myself walking a short stretch with a friendly couple who look and sound as though they've mistakenly wandered out of the original Glastonbury Festival and have been trying to find their way back in for the last 40 years. They've recently walked the Camino de Santiago de Compostela, the world-famous pilgrimage in Spain. They speak enthusiastically about the communal spirit they encountered on the walk. They tell me that they often come and spend a long weekend walking this section of the coast path because they find that it too has this same sense of comradeship. I'm beginning to see that, I say. It's definitely true that I've met and talked to more fellow walkers in the past couple of days than the whole trip combined up to this point. The isolation offered by the coast path is, of course, one of the reasons I'm attempting this challenge. Yet, as the sun shines brightly in the cloudless sky above my sandal-clad comrades and I, it's difficult to think of anywhere else I'd rather be. Over the next 20 minutes or so, until we eventually part company, we continue to chat and swap stories, and they even offer to take my tent away for me. They live near Poole and say I'm welcome to swing by and pick it up when I get to the finish line. I politely decline, having vowed to myself to use the cumbersome deadweight more often from this point on. As I leave them behind, I wonder how many times over the coming weeks I'll curse that decision. My digs for tonight, however, are in the tiny but picturesque Port Gavern. I've elected to stay at the pub here instead of over the hill at the neighbouring Port Isaac due to the inflated prices of the latter. Apparently, Port Isaac, playing host to the filming of an ITV drama series called Doc Martin, is the reason behind every potential bed for the night being double the expected price. Each to their own. I arrive in Port Gavern in time for a late lunch. My sweaty processed sausage snack and melted Mars bar hit the spot and are enough for me to work up a healthy thirst. I check into the pub and take residence on a table outside in the sunshine, ale in hand, contentedly gazing out to sea. Two chaps of about my age, who I remember passing on the path earlier in the day, join me briefly after introducing themselves. They are on a week's walking holiday and are using a carrier service. This means their luggage is taxied from place to place for them and they don't have to carry any packs. I politely explain to them that this is cheating, but they're having none of it. They swig down a pint and continue on to Port Isaac, where they're staying tonight. Wealthy Doc Martin enthusiasts, no doubt. The next morning, I leave Port Gavern on the steeply climbing road towards Port Isaac. The going is strenuous from the outset as I descend and ascend with muscle-aching familiarity. Scores of seabirds dance above me in the orange glow of the early morning sunshine. The trail clings courageously to the hillside as it undulates in a manner that suggests it's attempting to shake the path off into the waves below. I arrive at the pretty cottages that make up Port Quinn, also known as the village that died, due to a 19th century tragedy whereby all the men of the village were drowned at sea during a fishing trip. This led to the women of the village being forced to abandon their homes, leaving Port Quinn to fall into ruin. I stare out at the currently calm turquoise, I'm definitely using it too many times now, sea, as I amble past the tiny village of the damned. So many different things to so many people, a walking companion, a livelihood, or an untimely end. The walking continues to be challenging and breathtakingly beautiful until I arrive at the sandy beaches of Polzath, where I stop for lunch. A short while thereafter, and the path has flattened out, and the going is easy, as Harry Enfield appears up ahead. I do a comical double take, but it's definitely him, walking alongside a small terrier dog. The path is single file, and so I stand aside to let him pass. Oh no, it should be me letting you pass, you're the one carrying the backpack. No worries at all, I say, and we briefly exchange weather-related pleasantries as he walks by. The whole exchange lasts only seconds, but is a totally surreal experience. I think largely because I'm out here in the middle of nowhere, and I'm not really prepared for the appearance of TV comedians. Over the next few minutes,
I think of all the funny things I could have said to Harry Enfield to make him want to be instantly my friend. I should have opened with, "Only me?" I decide to text Tasha and tell her about my experience mingling with the stars. After a minute or so, she replies with this text, written here, word for word, exactly as it was sent. "Did you ask him to use his shower?" I may live to be 100 and never understand the complex intricacies of this woman's mind. The walking over the next hour or so is easy going as the path gently winds its way onwards. I inadvertently commit beetle genocide as they suddenly swarm the ground in front of me in biblical, plague-like quantities. The day is turning into an emotional roller coaster. First Enfield, and now hundreds of gory deaths on my conscience. I'm apologetically wiping the gooey remains of entire families, communities even, from the soles of my boots, using a tuft of grass, when I hear a voice holler from behind me. "It would have been better for the image if your bag had been orange rather than green. But I got some good shots anyway." I look up, perplexed, and see a bearded, middle-aged man approaching me with a large camera. "Hope you don't mind, but I've been walking some ways back and have taken some photos with you in them." "Oh, no, no, not at all." He has an American accent, and this, combined with his baseball cap and general attire, instantly reminded me of John Malkovich's character in the film Empire of the Sun. "I got to tell you, I didn't think the UK would be this beautiful," he says, as he stares ahead at the picturesque view with my final destination for the day, Padstow, visible in the distance. "Is that Padstow, do you know?" "Yes, I'm pretty sure it is," I say, and we fall in step together and carry on along the path. As we get chatting, it transpires that he's actually Canadian, not American. He has travelled all the way from Vancouver, where he works as a dentist, just to walk this section of the southwest coast path. Even though, as he explains, he is an obsessive walker, this still amazes me. To think that this incredible trail is known of and sought after the world over. I've made a point of not using the real names of anyone I meet along the way up to this point, Harry Enfield notwithstanding. So I'll call this fellow Basie, which is the name of Malkovich's character in the aforementioned Spielberg flick. We continue across sandy beaches and gently winding cliffs until we eventually reach the ferry crossing the past rock beach that will take us into Padstow. It's the first ferry crossing of the trail, and I'm surprised to note a touch of childlike excitement as I haul my giant backpack onto the seat beside me, much to the disdain of the other passengers crowded into the small, uncomfortable fishing boat. When we arrive in Padstow, we instinctively head for the nearest pub where Basie orders us 2 pints of Guinness. I'm not a Guinness drinker, and fear the worst when he downs his in record time. Over the next few hours, we break through the constraints of our social barriers by getting blind, steaming drunk on the thick black nectar. As generally happens on these occasions, we dutifully bare our souls. I explain the best I can my reasons for this trip, the insomnia and the general longing for a different direction in life. He does likewise with tales of separation and a desire to rediscover some kind of drive or purpose beyond that of plaque removal and root canals. When I confess that I still, for my sins, enjoy the very occasional cigarette, Basie pushes back the baseball cap over his bald scalp, exactly as John Malkovich would do, and proclaims, "I've lost good buddies, Steve. Damn good buddies." For some reason, this causes me to burst out laughing, which could have gone down badly, but thankfully just evokes the same reaction in him, and from this point on, everything gets a bit chaotic. I recall being shown some spectacular photographs of trails through the mountains and forests of Canada. Then we're in a taxi, and I'm explaining to the patient driver that I've no idea where the campsite I'm staying at is, and finding it impossible to comprehend that he wouldn't have this information already. Basie at some point departs for whichever hotel he's staying in, and I'm eventually dropped off at the first campsite the driver is able to find. As far as I can fathom, I then decide that this is the perfect evening to try out wild camping for the first time. I head back to the coast in the setting sun to root out a picturesque spot. Saturday night in Newquay. Hedgehog ice cream and seals. When I awake, my head feels as though Simon Callow has climbed inside through my ear hole during the night and sat on my brain, screaming as loud as he can, for 6 solid hours. I'm lying on my side on the floor of the tent, without a ground mat. The whole right side of my body is one aching mass, and my uninflated travel pillow is covered in a layer of drool. I clamber outside into the piercing early morning sunlight. The tent is erected next to a dry stone wall at the edge of a field adjoining the path itself. I would probably struggle to find a more obvious or less suitable spot along the entire coast path. I drink down a whole bottle of water in one long swig and begrudgingly begin to pack up the tent. I'm still fully clothed from yesterday, so that at least saves me one task. I stagger along the path, trying to straighten my spine and get some kind of feeling back in my right buttock. I've only been walking a short distance when I come across a giant sinkhole in the hillside. It's the size of a large house. The new Rowley, Rowley 2, on his maiden voyage today, advises me that this is a collapsed cave. I take a minute to thank my lucky stars that I didn't happen upon this hole last night and wake up this morning at the bottom of it. The going is generally flat, and I'm grateful for a refreshing sea breeze that helps to ease the effects of my slowly dissipating hangover. I walk across the sandy beach at Harlyn Bay and on past a striking lifeboat station before reaching the lighthouse at Trevose Head, where I finally collapse for lunch and a short siesta. I start to feel more human as I make my way onwards towards Constantine Bay. Some while later, a small Jack Russell being chased by a man that looks like a slightly overweight Pee Wee Herman appears on the path ahead of me. I arrest the progress of the mutt by making a fuss of it whilst the out-of-breath owner catches up. He thanks me and tells me the animal has unfortunately worked out how to free itself from a recently purchased lead. He has been chasing it on and off for the entire day. We chat for a while, and after commenting that I looked like I'd been dragged through a hedge backwards, he wishes me luck for the rest of the journey. My energy levels are low, and my right leg is causing me some pain, presumably a consequence of my intoxicated bed-making skills. As I hobble onwards, I reach a sign advising me I'm now entering Boobies Bay. I take a photo of the sign and send it to some friends over WhatsApp with the caption, "All right, leave this to me, I'll investigate." Alas, the bay does not live quite up to its name, and so I limp onwards towards my resting place for the day, Trianon Bay. My only options for the night are the YHA on the beachfront, or a second night under the canvas. And so I obviously make straight for the first youth hostel of the journey. The dorm room is basic, but cheap, and I'm tired enough to be grateful for anything over and above the tent. I'm sat on the beach later that evening, staring up at streaks of bright red and pink sky through the dusk clouds. The black shimmering sea is filled with silently bobbing gulls, allowing the waves to carry them up and down. After a long while, I turn to walk back towards the glowing lights of the hostel, when the headlights of a van appear in the distance and rumble up to the main entrance. There is a loud singing and chanting coming from within as a second van appears. A rugby team on tour booked into the hostel for the night. Excellent news. The friendly girl at reception advises me that my dorm room won't be invaded, as she's ensured they're all housed in the other 3 rooms. I thank her extensively for this and make my way past the drunken chorus and up the stairs. It's a loud night, but after a number of hours, my tired bones and weary mind finally give in to a deep, dreamless sleep. As the sun rises over the boisterous turquoise... Seriously, stop saying turquoise. Waves, the next morning, I'm already strolling the rocky coastline out of Trianon. My leg is still causing me some discomfort, so I've been forced to neck back some ibuprofens with my Weetabix. There is a powerful wind this morning that marks a stark contrast to the sunny, summer-like days I've been enjoying recently. The walking is easy for the first stretch leading to the stunning Porthcawthen Bay. I'm not the only early bird out and about, as surfers fill the sea here, taking advantage of the wind-driven waves. The next stretch through to Watergate Bay is the North Cornish coast at its finest. Far-reaching views in both directions as I cling to the cliff edge in the blowing wind. The path winds in and out of rocky coves, with steep climbs and descents thrown in all over the shop. As the blustery conditions reach their crescendo, I'm almost at 45 degrees just to stay upright. A man with a large grey Sergeant Major moustache passes me in the opposite direction. The fierce wind is behind him as he comically flails about the place with limbs that seem to have minds of their own. As we pass each other, he shouts through a tightly enclosed hood, "Doesn't get any better. Lost my rain cover back there. Don't know why we do this to ourselves. Enjoy your day." "You too. Best of luck," I shout in return. I reach the Bedruthen steps, huge jagged rocks that rise up in a line along the sandy beach. Rowley spins me a yarn about one of them being called the Samaritan, because a ship once crashed into it and spilled its cargo of food supplies for the locals to nab. Then on to Watergate Bay, and 3 miles of walking across the sound with the vast, rocky cliffs as a foreboding backdrop. The popular surfing resort of Newquay, where I'm due to stay the night, is within view for most of the day. I stop to gaze lovingly at a buzzard in flight. The graceful manoeuvring of the birds of prey along the coastline has already become one of the standout highlights of the trip so far. Later that afternoon, I'm sprawled out on a bench in the town of Porth, just outside Newquay, taking a breather. An elderly lady approaches me and inquires how far I've walked. A timely ego boost ensues as she praises my resolve and proclaims that she wishes more young people would follow my example of exploration rather than swanning off to Thailand and partaking in Lord knows what for their gap years. I decide not to mention that I'm nearly 40 and really should be at work. I check into a hotel in Newquay offering rooms for £30 a night. I'm slightly fearful, as it happens to be a Saturday night in the stag do capital of the southwest. However, I needn't have worried, as it becomes immediately apparent that I'm roughly 50 years below the average age of the rest of the hotel guests. There is a bingo hall and a poster advertising a Frank Sinatra tribute act performing later that night in the main dining hall. Saturday night in Newquay sorted. In truth, after taking a wander around the town and grabbing a bite to eat, I spend the evening in my room listening to Jim Bob reading an audio version of his novel Driving Jarvis Ham. I've been gone 16 days and walked some 190 miles, nearly a third of the journey gone already. I'd expect by now Tasha, along with my family and friends, are all in fits of deep depression, missing me uncontrollably and counting down the minutes until I return. They're probably all on the phone to each other now, talking about me, or maybe having a We Miss Steve get-together, where they tearfully swap Steve stories as a giant screen displays pictures of my face in the background. The next morning begins with a walk through the unattractive high streets of the town centre, peppered with plastic, pint glasses, beer cans and half-eaten bags of chips covered in rivers of ketchup and mayonnaise. The occasional puddle of vomit and accompanying stench contaminate the morning sea air. The total silence, save for the feasting gulls, as I sift my way through the debris, conjures up post-apocalyptic images from numerous movies. This all changes soon enough, however, as I move from the midst of a ghost town into the invigorating bustle of the attractive working harbour. I then finally begin to climb out of Newquay via a pleasant enough residential area and onto open country and cliff tops in the bright sunshine. A short, easy stretch follows to take me to the tidal bridge crossing over the River Gannel. Rowley gives me fair warning that much of today's hike to Perranporth will be across beaches and sand dunes. He also points out, with a touch of arrogance in my opinion, that I've apparently wandered straight past Hua's Hut, a white brick structure stood overlooking Newquay Bay. This isn't the first time something of this nature has happened, and I wonder if I'm subconsciously entering into some kind of trance-like state whilst walking, probably not advisable whilst traversing the clifftop paths. It's generally thought, by which I mean I've decided, that as far as the noble art of thinking is concerned, walkers fit into two distinct categories. The first is the walker who walks to think. The walk is where you sort all your problems out and return to normal life with an action plan at the ready. The second walker is the walker who walks to not think, whereby the walk is the only place where you are able to switch off, clear your head, and focus purely on the journey in front of you. Although from time to time I fit into both of these categories, I'm predominantly from the latter camp. Walking to me, and in particular the long-distance trail, is life brought back to its purest and simplest form. All that matters is in front of you. Just put one foot in front of the other. Walk, eat, walk. Find a place to sleep and repeat. It's concerning me, however, that I may be entering into the spirit of this mindset a touch too literally and wandering zombie-like around the most beautiful coastline in the world without noticing half of it. I vow to stop and smell the flowers more often from here on in. A timely conclusion as I enter a particularly picturesque stretch overlooking Crantock Beach, heading towards Holywell. An army of seabirds perform an intricate swooping and diving display above me as the sunlight dapples the hillside path. Lower down, hidden within the flowering hedgerows, a choir of invisible songbirds provide the angelic soundtrack. All the while the glistening sea laps seductively at the golden sands far below my dusty boots as they tread cautiously onwards so as to avoid the countless insects on their daily commute. The increasing presence of all manner of creepy crawlies provides confirmation of summer's pending triumphant arrival. How's that for noticing your surroundings? As I reach Holywell, I spot the elderly lady I met in Porth the day before, and we get chatting for a second time. She is the first fellow walker I've met to advise me to keep lugging the tent around. She points out that accommodation will get a good deal punchier once I hit the south coast. I have already made up my mind to hang on to be honest, but it's good to hear from someone who doesn't think I'm a fool to keep hauling the extra weight around. There are days when it still feels like an albatross around my neck, but in general, I've gotten used to it. We wish each other well, and I head off into the sand dunes. I'm not far into the slog across the dunes before the novelty of clambering up loose sandhills and sliding down the other side has well and truly worn off. My boots are full of sand, and the humid heat has left me covered in a clammy sweat. By the time I finally arrive in Perranporth, I'm exhausted and emitting an odour that combines pickled onions and wet dog. I'm staying in a room above a pub on the seafront. The place itself isn't one of the most beautiful spots on the path so far, and first impressions are of a scaled-down Newquay. The pub, with Sky Sports, happy hour and ham, egg and chips for dinner, backs up this assertion. I'm not complaining, however, as it's cheap, friendly, and I quite fancy some ham, egg and chips for dinner. After washing enough times to remove most of the sand from my sun-reddened body and scoffing down the aforementioned English staple, I wander down to the beach and watch the surfers in the evening sun with an ale or two for company. I can still taste the toothpaste the following morning when the path takes me into a new and alien landscape. The 12.5-mile slog from Perranporth to Portreath travels through a long-since abandoned mining area. The track winds through jagged, exposed rocks, revealing scores of hidden caves, mine shafts, and the ruins of old tin mine buildings. The green, blue, and turquoise, I could use azure, is that the same as turquoise? Landscape of the previous few days is replaced with cold shades of orange and brown. The whole scene reminds me of Tom Baker-era Doctor Who, and I'm expecting to see a Zygon appear from behind a rock or hear Elizabeth Sladen screaming for me to come and rescue her. Note to self. This makes you sound like a nerd. Remember to replace with something much cooler for the second draft. Rowley advises me that the caves and mine shafts dotted across the landscape around me are full to bursting point with bats, including some rare species. I transfer into brave explorer mode and fearlessly clamber up to a cave entrance. It's dark. Seriously dark. Picture darkness. Yep, this is much darker. I creep tentatively inside on tiptoes, like I'm in an episode of Scooby-Doo. I'm just reaching for my trusty pocket torch when I remember. I don't have a trusty pocket torch. I turn to the trusty old light on my phone instead, which rallies spectacularly and shines a brilliant light illuminating the 1 millimeter area directly surrounding my phone. Oh well, a gallant effort thwarted only by a completely unavoidable lack of resources. The walking is challenging, with plenty of tiring climbs, but the views as I reach Cligger Head are worth every drop of perspiration. That being said, it's a welcome, if slightly surreal, sight when I happen across a small cafe nestled between the cliffs at Chapel Porth. I consult Rowley, and sure enough, he is aware of this isolated haven for the coastal rambler. Furthermore, he insists that I try the hedgehog. This turns out to be Cornish ice cream smothered in Cornish clotted cream and rolled in honey-roasted hazelnuts. When in Rome? As I'm stood at the counter, waiting for my order to be expertly constructed and visibly salivating, I note a sign on the wall proudly proclaiming, "All our bacon and sausages are fried in Cornish clotted cream." I briefly entertain the idea of asking the friendly owner taking my order if she'll marry me. Hedgehog in hand, I sit myself at one of the outside tables looking out to sea. After a short while, a small crowd has gathered and the seating area is full. It's as though the cafe is a lighthouse for walkers. There's a group of folks wearing matching T-shirts with "The Big 6:30" written on them. I get talking to them and discover that one amongst their number is walking the whole coast path for charity, and the others are joining him for certain stretches along the way. I explain sheepishly that I'm not doing this for charity, but that, although I don't have an enthusiastic entourage with me at this exact moment, my friends did give me their guarantee that they'd come and visit me along the way. So I'm sure this will happen any day now. When I've dispatched the delicious hedgehog, I stand, looking down at my backpack, wearily contemplating heaving the blasted thing over my shoulders once more. Just then, the cafe owner appears behind me, holding a flapjack the size of my foot. She has overheard me saying I'm walking the whole path, and sends me on my way with a complimentary example of her cooking prowess. I consider the marriage proposal for a second time. She is maybe 20 years older than me, but I figure if everything I'd be eating post our wedding day was fried in clotted cream, then this probably wouldn't be an issue, as I'd be unlikely to make 50. Throughout the afternoon, the mining remains continue to adorn the cavernous coastline. I can see tomorrow's destination of St. Ives in the distance, as the gulls and guillemots gather in the skies above. I pass several hang gliders somewhere near St. Agnes and take a few moments to enviously observe them floating amongst the seabirds in the gentle afternoon breeze. Just as my feet start to ache, I begin the descent into Portreath, where I'm booked into a room above one of the two local pubs. It's currently undergoing renovation, so yours truly has negotiated yet another bargain basement price. Portreath appears to be going through a process of gentrification, becoming a more upmarket holiday getaway, perhaps. There are countless new homes under construction, and an almost entirely new town feels as though it's emerging. The pub I'm staying in is evidence of this transformation. It's partway between an old-fashioned local pub, complete with fruit machine and fluffy carpets, and its new, trendy guys, with industrial-style furniture and a selection of craft beers. After a meal of fish and chips served on a chopping board, I order an ale and I call my folks. I then call Tasha and have a frank discussion regards the continued lack of things fried in clotted cream in our daily lives, a situation I advise that we both must strive to remedy. The next morning at breakfast, I'm mulling over the prospect of the day's long 18-mile hike to St. Ives, trying to decide if I'm due a second rest day. The odour my clothes are emitting doesn't seem quite as violent as just prior to previous wash day, but I'm conscious that I may have simply become accustomed to that particular stench. I study the face of the pub landlady as she pours my coffee for any signs of veiled disgust. Nothing. Although she does very kindly insist on making me a cheese butty to take away with me, so perhaps there's a hidden subtext in there somewhere. A couple of early tough climbs shortly after leaving Portreath rid me of any further thoughts of relaxation. It's not long, however, before the walking becomes much easier as the path settles atop the steep cliffs for a prolonged stretch. The warm, bright sunshine is the perfect accompaniment to the lush green cliff tops and hedgerows bustling with songbirds and buzzing insects. The cloudless blue skies complete the dreamy scene as I wander on contentedly. After an hour or two, I reach the beautiful God Ravy with its impressive lighthouse perched on its own island amongst the gently purring waves. I stop for an early lunch and sit happily on the cliff edge, munching away at my pre-prepared cheese butty. A brief movement from down below on the rocky shoreline catches my eye. I stare downwards for a moment whilst the truth slowly dawns on me. The collection of large rocks strewn over the pebbles below are in fact a group of about 20 seals, basking lazily in the midday sun. At last I'm seeing a glimpse of what Rowley and numerous passers-by have been promising in abundance for days. With a gigantic smile plastered across my wide-eyed face, I lie on my belly watching them, with my head poking out over the cliff edge. I snap hundreds of photographs from this secretive vantage point, like a member of the paparazzi clicking away at some unsuspecting celebrities in their swimming costumes on a beach in Mallorca. Instead of a telescopic lens, however, I have a cheap smartphone. As a result, I have hundreds of pictures of distant, blurry rocks on a nondescript shoreline. I care not, though, as I continue to watch the beautiful creatures sunbathing. I feel as though the world is a pretty wonderful place, all things considered. After dragging myself away, I continue along the cliff tops for a while longer before arriving at another section of sand dunes. They stretch off into the distance, and my feet and leg muscles give a little wince at the prospect. I decide to remove the boots and socks, roll up the trousers, and walk along the beach through the gently lapping waves, rather than across the dunes. The scene feels more like the south of France than England in April. The white sands merge seamlessly with the royal blue sea, and the horizon in the distance is a perfect straight line. The clear sky above is no more than a single shade of blue lighter. Gulls sit motionless in the water, eyeing me as I pass in the warmth of the afternoon sunlight. Yet, as feared, it does not take long for the feeling of serenity to be replaced with aches and grumbles as the humid heat becomes stifling and my pace slows on the sand underfoot. By the time I reach the mouth of the estuary, which will take me around the town of Hale and back down to St. Ives, I'm exhausted. Forward another hour or so as I approach Hale, and I'm grizzling like a stroppy child and I'm just about ready to drop. Rowley is banging on about some historical swing bridge that I simply must see, whilst my pack seems now to be physically pushing me to floor. Under different circumstances, I'm sure Hale is a lovely Cornish town with plenty going for it. At this moment, however, I'm willing it out of existence. I pause outside a giant supermarket that looks like an art gallery and catch my breath. I've walked my daily average already, and still have another 5 or 6 miles to go before I reach St. Ives. I consider changing my plans and finding a bed for the night here in Hale. I could then have a half day tomorrow instead of a day off, and just walk the last few miles in the morning. I go back and forth on this for a few minutes, unsure of what to do. What would Jim Bob do? Probably pen a pun-laced masterpiece, perfectly encapsulating the shortcomings of the modern world. I'd like to hear it, but it doesn't seem like a realistic action plan for my current situation. In the end, I gallantly resolve to carry on. As a result, I'm feeling pretty heroic as I hobble out of Hale back along the other side of the estuary. Some way along, I meet a woman, out on a day's hike, who is also heading for St. Ives. She is a clear foot taller than me and resembles a young Annie Lennox, with cropped, bleached hair. She is striding at pace with walking poles, but Seeing no doubt that my spirits are dampened, she slows her pace to match mine, and we walk the final 4 or so miles together. I go through the, by now mechanical, telling of my journey plans, and she reacts with pleasing enthusiasm. She is completing the same journey as myself, but one weekend at a time instead of all in one go. As the path winds its way through affluent residential areas and strips of woodland, we swap stories concerning some locations already passed. She stayed in the same pub as me in Clovelly and passionately loves Verity in Ilfracombe. We chat too about places still ahead of us, and then she vocalises something that's been quietly concerning me for a while now. The prospect that by the time I hit Land's End in a few days, the very best of this trail will already be behind me. Sobering stuff. Eventually we arrive in St. Ives with the afternoon sunshine still in full swing. We stop for an ice cream at the first seaside cafe we reach before wishing each other well and saying our goodbyes. I book into another hotel catering for the more senior clientele. As with the hotel in Newquay, it's wondrously inexpensive and boasts its own bingo lounge. I mean, what more could you want? The lady at reception is clearly slightly perplexed by my presence, but greets me with a smile. I book a room for 2 nights, having decided a day off enjoying the sights of St. Ives is definitely in order. The following morning, once the Weetabix are duly dispatched, I head off to find a laundrette and some entertainment for the day. St. Ives is a beautiful place with narrow, cobbled streets adorned with art galleries, museums and independent retailers. There is a hive of trendy eateries surrounding the picture postcard harbour, and although the weather is distinctly greyer than yesterday, the whole town bustles with activity. Whilst waiting for the old pants and socks to go through their somewhat less than weekly service, I wander around a fishing museum and grab lunch at a swanky pasta restaurant. I think one of the 2 ladies on the table next to mine used to present Blue Peter, but I can't be sure. A pleasant afternoon is spent exploring the town and lounging by the harbour listening to an audiobook of P.G. Wodehouse stories. All in all, my second day off is a vast improvement on the first. That being said, as I lie waiting for sleep's embrace later that night, I'm nonetheless desperate to get back on the trail. Slush puppies at the end of the world, open-air rehearsals and the Paris Hotel. The walk to Zena the next morning is a short but challenging one. At only 6.5 miles, it's much shorter than any day's walk up to this point. In part, this is because I've bookmarked Zena as a place I want to visit. It's famous for its connection to D.H. Lawrence, who once described it as the most beautiful place in the world. It's also home to the Tinner's Arms, apparently a contender for the best pub on the whole coast path. Fair enough. I wasn't able to book a room at the Tinner's, but have secured lodgings at a nearby B&B. The walk begins easily enough with a stroll out of St. Ives, past the Tate Gallery, onto an area called Clodgy Point. The weather is threatening to turn and the waves below me are becoming agitated. The going then gets very tough very quickly. The landscape becomes rugged and the path increasingly treacherous as it winds in and out and sometimes over jagged rock formations. The ground is slippery, and during the steeper climbs I have to cling on to the rocks to stay upright. Although the descents and ascents are not as vast as in some of the earlier sections, they are more acute than anything I've yet experienced. At times it feels more like rock climbing than walking. As you might expect, the views are simply stunning, and there is a real sense of remoteness here that I've not felt since the opening few days in North Devon. I then pass a strange, far too modern-looking uniform, stone circle, with a path of stepping stones leading to it. I observe a few nearby signposts and consult Rowley to discover that the circle belongs to a campsite not far from here. It makes up part of a short circular walk they've constructed for the enjoyment of their clientele. As I walk across a meticulously laid out boardwalk section, I'm sure I detect a hint of scorn in Rowley's usually deadpan delivery. Shortly after this, I stopped for lunch in a small clearing, sheltered from the strengthening winds. Whilst I gorge on my faux salami and accompanying Mars bar, I see a young rabbit emerge tentatively from underneath a large rock. It hops around excitedly for a minute or so before settling and chomping contentedly on the grassy verge a few metres away from me. I wonder how our Bovril is getting on, and picture him sprawled out under the dining table, or perhaps ripping to shreds any personal items that anyone has been foolish enough to leave lying around. His most favourite of all...